If it may please the court, Mark with the Three Wolf Epiphany on behalf of Ricky Banks. Thank you, Judge. This is a case where I could come before the court this morning and say, here I am, I'm John Wayne, and I'm going to rescue the defendant. And in that particular instance, you would all look at me and think, well, here's a guy with delusions of grandeur. And that's the first thing I'm going to address in this particular instance. The idea of fundamental fairness and the idea of ineffective assistance of counsel. Mr. Harvey Bass was lead counsel in this case. As your honors are aware, and as we have supplemented the record, Mr. Bass suffers from severe mental illness to the point where there was a guardian appointed for Mr. Bass in the Circuit Court of Cook County, Illinois. Mr. Bass was the lead attorney for Ricky Banks throughout this case. Mr. Banks, referring to the references of the MD who rendered her opinion, Mr. Bass has been ill, mentally ill, for approximately 10 years. In 1993 or 1994, Mr. Bass lost his license to practice law for a period of approximately 6 months. He subsequently re-entered into the practice of law, subsequently was hired by Ricky Banks to defend him on a two-count indictment. An indictment that, by the way, was issued on the last day it could be issued. Throughout this process, and the record is replete, Mr. Bass, failed on numerous occasions to exercise appropriate, effective assistance of counsel. The government has argued that in the first instance, there was an informant in this case, a tipster, if you would. And since Mr. Bass did not request the identity of the tipster, he was not entitled to know who that tipster was, and the government was not obligated to disclose the name of that tipster. Subsequently, as your honors are aware, Mr. Banks did discover the identity of the tipster on the eve of trial. There was a renewed motion to suppress. There was a second attorney in the case, Eugene Pinchum, who was brought in at the last minute. Mr. Pinchum conducted the motions to suppress because Mr. Bass apparently was not able to. By the time they figured out who the tipster was, there certainly wasn't a sufficient amount of time to prepare to rerun that motion. In addition to that, at the close of all the evidence and after the verdict of the jury finding Mr. Banks guilty on the second count of the indictment, the court indicated to Mr. Bass that it would be inclined to order a new trial in the event there was a motion filed. Mr. Bass did not file that motion. Judge, I believe that Mr. Pinchum was not present. Mr. Pinchum was there strictly for the purpose of conducting examination and cross-examination of the witnesses. That's why Mr. Pinchum was there. No, Your Honor. I would submit to the court, and in light of the mental health records that we have supplemented the file with, clearly indicate that Mr. Bass just was not capable of dealing with this case. He was not capable of meeting the deadlines. He was not capable of effectively representing Mr. Banks. He didn't do what he needed to do. He blew a deadline after a judge tells him, hey, it's likely that I'm going to order a new trial. Where's the motion for a new trial? Not there. Not for months. Well after the time has expired. Additional issues. Besides that, there's evidence that comes in that the jury hears, and subsequently the court tells the jury, well, you've got to disregard this evidence. This evidence is remarkably prejudicial in a drug case. The first bit of evidence revolves around a gun. Testimony of Ricky Evans that that Mr. Banks admitted at his bond hearing that he had a gun. Well, I don't know about Fifth Amendment, but I think subsequently Judge Gottschall, subsequently after allowing this into evidence, after lunch, told the jury, you know that gun evidence that was here? I want you to disregard it now, no matter how difficult it is. This is a jury of 12 people, 12 lay people. Second bit of evidence, which is also equally as interesting, and the jury has even more time to deliberate each and every one of them over this evidence, regards the issue of the dog and the dog sniffing around the vehicle and the dog subsequently identifying the vehicle as there's the drugs. The jury hears all this evidence, comes in, the jury is dismissed for the weekend. The jury comes back the following Monday. The jury is told again by Judge Gottschall, well, I know how difficult this might be, but you must disregard this evidence that has been testified to regarding the dog and the drugs. Again, very difficult for 12 men to disregard this kind of evidence, or 12 men and women, if you would. The tipster in this case, Johnny Banks, this is the defendant's brother. It's presumed that because it's the defendant's brother, and argued to a degree by the government, that since it's his brother, you should know the background of this guy, and that the disclosure, and let me strike that, it wasn't disclosure, because it was only discovered by the defendant when the testimony was being elicited from the officers. It was discovered by the defendant, and he realized that Johnny Banks, his brother, was in fact the tipster in this case. It was never disclosed to the defendant by the government at any time. The government contends because the defendant doesn't request it, that the government is not obligated to disclose this information. Fundamental fairness is the underlying concept of this case here. You're prosecuting somebody. The government is to prosecute them zealously, utilizing all the facts that it has at its fingertips. However, the bottom line is, the idea is that they are to do justice. It's not win or lose. Not win or lose. It's not about the government wins or the defendant wins. It's about justice being done in this particular instance. And in this particular case, if you take the accumulation of the evidence that was improperly presented to the jury, the evidence which the jury had time to consider, and even though instructed to disregard this evidence, I've been in front of too many juries in my lifetime that I've never understood where a verdict of guilty or not guilty has come from. Sometimes I think it's only due to my own brilliance, and then I'm disappointed to find out it had nothing to do with anything that either I did or the defendant did or anybody else, that it might have just been some inconsequential little thing. So I don't know how effective it is, and that's why I think Judge Gotchel advised Mr. Bass at the time that if he were to file a motion for a new trial, she was likely to grant that motion for a new trial. Well, from my readings of the mental health records and the issues regarding delusions of grandeur, Judge, I believe that, and you're asking me to speculate, and that's all I can do is speculate. Why didn't the judge recognize that, Mr. Bass? And, well, Judge, if you have an attorney who is blowing deadlines throughout the case, who is not filing a motion for a new trial, well, Gene Pinchum did most of the examination of witnesses. Mr. Bass did not do the examination of the witnesses. And that was a key point here. No, I'm not, because Gene Pinchum was brought in at the last minute, Judge. He was not familiar with the pretrial proceedings. He did not participate in the pretrial proceedings. I mean, the whole gist of this case is it's accumulation of ineffective assistance, which... Go ahead. That's correct. I believe, Judge, that he did not. Mr. Pinchum is gone. He's conducted his examination. And then Mr. Bass is told at the conclusion of the trial, when they have the bond hearing, because they wanted to extend Mr. Banks's bond. Yes, yes. Yeah. Pardon me, Judge? Yes, Judge. Thank you.
May I please the court, counsel? Good morning. Your Honor, the defendant in this case was fairly convicted by a jury based on substantial evidence, only one piece of which was a package of 600 grams of cocaine which bore the defendant's fingerprint. The defendant's efforts to cast doubt on the accuracy and fairness of the jury's verdict did not withstand scrutiny, and here are some of the reasons why. First of all of the defendant's claims that relate to the motion to suppress and the informant all rest on the false premise that the informant's testimony was or would have been exculpatory or helpful to the defense. And that's simply not the case. In fact, the opposite was true, as the record reveals. The record shows that before the trial, the informant was produced before the district court and was examined on direct examination by the defense counsel. And at the conclusion of that examination, the district court expressly credited the testimony of both the officers and the informant and determined, based on that testimony, that the officers had received a tip regarding a potential or planned drug deal. They had conducted surveillance on the basis of that tip, and that the combination of the information they had received and their observations at the location planned for the drug deal provided them with probable cause to arrest the defendant. The district court judge got it absolutely right, and because that is true, and also because evidence or information regarding the informant, not only the substantive evidence regarding the informant's tip, but also the identity of the informant, was not suppressed and was not exculpatory, and it, with respect to the identity, was also not producible to the defendant under Roviero. So the government's contention here isn't that the government was entitled to withhold the identity of the informant because the defendant didn't ask. The government's position is we were entitled to withhold the identity of the informant based on settled law that allows the government to do so where the informant is not called as a witness, which he was not in this case, and was not a participant in the drug deal, which, again, he was not in this case. So because the informant's testimony was inculpatory rather than exculpatory, all of the defendant's arguments regarding prosecutorial misconduct and ineffective assistance and, substantively, the district court's denial of the motion to suppress all fall based on that fact. The defendant's arguments regarding purported trial errors are equally without merit. First, with respect to the testimony regarding the defendant's admission at the state court bond hearing. Most fundamentally, what the defendant is arguing is that the prosecutor lacked a good faith basis for asking defendant about an admission he made to Darlene April during his cross-examination at trial. The record reflects that, of course, the prosecutor, in fact, had a good faith basis, but beyond that, the most fundamental point with respect to that evidence is that the evidence was stricken and the jury was directed to disregard it. And the best evidence of the fact that the jury, in fact, did follow that instruction is that they acquitted the defendant on the only count to which that evidence related, count one. The possession of the gun took place with respect to the drug deal the first night of the events of this case, and that is the count that the jury acquitted the defendant of. So there can be no doubt that the jury's first hearing, the evidence that was later stricken on this point, was absolutely harmless. The defendant also argues with respect to the admission of testimony regarding his possession of a gun, that evidence was correctly admitted by the district court under well-settled Seventh Circuit precedent. And the district court judge's offhand comments regarding the issue cannot override her ultimate ruling, which was that the probative value of the evidence was not exceeded by any unfair prejudice. Yes, Your Honor. But what's at issue here is her rulings. And she admitted that evidence. And in very much the same way, the court cannot overlook the district court's ruling with respect to the new trial. Because even after filing the appeal, the defendant brought a motion for a new trial based on purportedly newly discovered evidence. And as the record reflects, the district court judge denied that motion as well. That, again, related to the informant, and the record reflects that the judge had definitely changed her view with respect to the relative merits of the motion for new trial by that point in time, and indeed, the record reflects that the judge had changed her view regarding those issues long before that. At sentencing, the judge indicated she was, let me explain the context. The defendant argued at sentencing that he should not be held accountable for the gun because there was a lack of probable cause for defendant's arrest, and therefore the gun should not be held against him at sentencing. The district court judge expressly stated, after everything I heard, including the informant, I'm not going to make any ruling like that, or to those effect, or that effect. And likewise at sentencing, the district court ruled that based on the evidence that she heard and saw, she viewed the conduct of which defendant had been convicted as being the tip of the iceberg of the defendant's illegal activities. So you're right that the judge did make quite a few comments during the trial, but what is important is how the judge actually ruled. I was, Your Honor. Yes, there was. Little background. Shortly before the trial commenced, the the government had trouble reaching Mr. Bass. Mr. Bass had changed his office location. We were unable to make deliveries to him, and we were unable to reach him by telephone. We requested, therefore, a hearing, a status hearing, just to find out whether we were going to proceed to trial or what was going on. And at that time, Mr. Bass appeared before Judge Gottschall, told Judge Gottschall that he'd be ready to go, and the trial was not continued. A week later, when we arrived ready for trial, Mr. Pinchem came with Mr. Bass, and the two of them made a last-minute motion for continuance. The judge denied the motion on the basis that a week before, Mr. Bass had come in and said that he was prepared to go, and as a result of Mr. Bass's statements, both the judge and the prosecutor had, gotten it together to be ready to proceed in 7 days, which in fact is what we did. Right. Yes, and first let me say that one thing that he did not say was that Mr. Bass is ill or Mr. Bass has been ill, other than he had been ill and in the hospital, which he told me. He told me he had pneumonia earlier. And so that representation was made. No, Your Honor, none whatsoever. He exhibited no symptoms of any psychiatric problem whatsoever. And nothing about anything like that was brought up. What was raised as a basis was a quote-unquote last-minute delivery of documents to the defense. In other words, they claimed that discovery was late and they had just now received discovery. The record reflects that that wasn't exactly true. Some of the documents they claimed to have just gotten had been provided to them the previous April. What was true was that a few documents had been provided to them under the Jenks Act fairly recently at trial, or at the time the prosecutor denied, and I deny here that it happened immediately before, but it had been provided fairly late, and that was brought on by the fact that the government's efforts to deliver the documents earlier were unsuccessful.
Right.
The documents at issue were, first of all, absolutely. Right. I understand, and I won't take it that way, but here's what happened. In the previous April, almost a year before the trial, the defendant was provided with a stack of documents which included a report from Officer Trafton, which stated, and this report is in the record, which stated that he, along with Officer Weiss, were assisting CPAT agent Jim Riley, along with Officer Brian Lewis, in following up on information that officers received of drug activity going on in the 2100 block of California. At that time, the officers believed they witnessed possible drug activity, this being a possible drug deal occurring at the location of 2132 California between a green Jeep Cherokee and a blue Chevy Corsica. That was received in April. In the following December, the government responded to the defendant's motion to suppress evidence. And in that response, the government specifically indicated that the government had, the police had received evidence that a drug deal was going to occur at a specific location, 2132 California, and that a specific car had been identified, a blue Jeep Corsica, and that the individuals who were to participate in the deal were a person named Ricky, who they understood to be Ricky Banks, and another person who would be driving the blue Corsica, and his name was Raymond Jackson. We provided that information in December. That's why the district court judge, when presented with this argument that they had just now learned about this information, said, oh no, that's completely false. You've known about that for months. What was provided shortly before the trial was the specific report of Officer Riley, which stated in sum and substance exactly what had been said in the government's response, which was that on March 1st, 96, at approximately 8:25 p.m., CW, cooperating witness, contacted S.A. Riley and advised me that a 2 to 3 kilo deal was going to take place at 2132 California Avenue. C.I. was talking to Raymond Jackson, who told him he had to go meet Ricky and the boys on California Avenue and deliver 2 to 3 kilos to Indiana for him. The deal was going to take place between 9 and 10 p.m. Jackson was driving a blue Corsica to Indiana. So this was the only thing that had come late. That's absolutely what I'm saying, and I'm saying that for a number of reasons. One, I personally orally advised Mr. Bass of all of this information months before the trial. So that's number one. Number two, Mr. Pinchum, in his arguments, if you look at the record, clearly understood all of this evidence, and there was no inquiry made of the government at any time with respect to whether a deal could be worked out. Indeed, that is something that had been discussed with Mr. Banks for months prior to the trial, and it was the government's view that we weren't even going to be going to trial. But so it's clear that everybody was aware of everything at that time. Number three, the additional evidence, there is no additional evidence. All of the substantive evidence was communicated to the defendant both orally by me and in the response to the motion to suppress months before. So it is absolutely not true that he was not aware of it. And finally, with respect to Mr. Bass's illness, first of all, that in the government's view, that evidence is actually not before you. It needs to be stricken, and it's evidence that only can be heard in the context of a 2255 proceeding. It was not presented to the district court. No record has been made with respect to that evidence. The government has had no opportunity to really respond to it. And finally, there was no evidence of any problem on behalf of Mr. Bass related to any mental illness. The only thing that we have here, and there was nothing in the trial. First of all, Mr. Bass conducted the opening statement, the closing argument, and he did question some witnesses. There was nothing in his performance that was anything like substandard, much less substandard to the point that would rise to the level of ineffective assistance of counsel. He came in 2 days before the trial began, and he conducted the proceedings on the two evidentiary hearings that were conducted on the motion to suppress prior to the trial, and he was present for the trial proceedings up to the final part of the trial where he was actually not present for the closing argument. That's a good point, Your Honor. The context of that was specifically a motion to revoke the defendant's bond, and that is the language of the rule. The judge found, in order to allow the defendant to remain on bond, the judge made that finding that there was a substantial likelihood of success on the merits. It's not as though there was full briefing or discussion where all of the merits of a potential new trial motion were raised before the judge. And in fact, the record reflects there was no good new trial motion. because the judge correctly decided that the informant's testimony hurt the defendant. So how could there be a new trial warranted? I mean, the bottom line is that there was probable cause. The district court judge correctly found that there was probable cause. There was no basis for a motion to suppress, and that is the cornerstone of this appeal, really. So the fact that the defendant's lawyer missed that deadline, which, you know, I'm not suggesting that's good, but it had no effect on the defendant because that motion would have been, must have been denied. And indeed, at this point in time when the defendant subsequently brought a new trial motion based on quote-unquote newly discovered evidence in the form of the informant's testimony, the judge denied the motion again. She gave the defendant the low end. So, Your Honor, we would, number one, the government would ask that any discussion about Mr. Bass's mental illness or lack of mental illness be not considered by Your Honors at this juncture because it's not appropriate here. And because this case was fairly tried and the defendant was fairly convicted, we would ask that you affirm both the defendant's conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Yes, we did understand that. Yes, we do understand. Yes. Yes, we will. Last things first. Your Honor has asked about the sentencing and what end of the sentencing spectrum Mr. Banks received. I just need to point out to the court that the panel that Mr. Banks did receive a 5-point enhancement for the gun. The gun that was taken, the gun that was not allowed into evidence for the jury to consider. Secondly, timing of discovery is everything. Timing of the tipster. I mean, here we are on the eve of trial. It's just too darn late. It's too late. Maybe. Well, I understand that's the government's position, but then again, when a gentleman as Mr. Bass was suffering from delusions of grandeur, they believe they can handle virtue. I believe, Judge, that when you refer to this record, that's excluding the supplementation that we made. Is that correct? It is in the court record that Mr. Bass was suffering from mental illness, flat depressed effect, no hallucinations, or as of the date of the report, which in this instance is Exhibit D, contained in our... As of August 14th, 2003, yes, this is, we previously filed a motion to supplement the record on appeal. Judge Gottschall allowed that motion, and we supplemented it with the report of physicians, the ARDC file, and the guardianship proceeding as well. Yes. Yes. Did we? No, no. The judge allowed the filing, and no, she said. I believe this was after sentencing. Yes, after notice of appeal. She. I believe, and for what it's worth, I think is the terminology that was used. I'm not 100% certain of that, so please don't hold me to that. Yes, it was. And the government argued against it. She allowed it. No, that is not a brief matter within the briefs. So, at this point, we would just have to simply argue at this point that the timing is everything. The gun was hugely prejudicial. I reference Your Honor's attention to Judge Gottschall's comments on the gun. In every drug case, there's a gun because it guarantees a conviction or... And the bottom line is that Bash should have asked to continue this trial. He didn't. Why? Because he had those illusions, because he had the delusions of grandeur, as when we do, we all say we're ready to go, and realities, there is no grasp on reality, no ability to deal with it. At this point, I have nothing further.
On page 36 of the brief. I just wanted to make it clear.